This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Half past three, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. With Derek Johnson, I'm Nick Schwert. Thanks for hanging out with us on a lovely Tuesday here in Lawrence, Kansas. Late Night in the Fog was on Saturday. I would guess that it is the biggest, the best, the grandest late night that KU has ever had, and they continue to set the bar for themselves every single year as we welcome on Matt Tate of the Lawrence Journal World. Matt, I was joking yesterday. I've been to probably a dozen late nights, and I was thinking back to the ones I went to in the late 90s and comparing it to what we saw on Saturday. They're not even the same event anymore, right? Like, it's an extravaganza right now that Kansas and maybe a few other programs across the country can match. And I just don't know where you go from here. Like, how do you continue to top yourself?
Yeah, no, it's not even close to the same event. I mean, for one, you know, it's definitely become, you know, that concert aspect of it has become the most important part and what gets everybody the most hype. I mean, the stands were even thinning out and emptying during the scrimmage portion. I mean, it was like the people that came this year didn't even stick around, all of them, to watch the basketball, which is what it used to be about. And then even that, I think, you know, the sort of the advent of the skits being able to be pre-recorded and filmed and then shown on the video board. I mean, back in the day, you know, you used to have guys actually doing skits live right there on the court. I mean, I can't remember exactly who it was, but I think it was Kirk Heinrich, was David Letterman. He had a top 10 list one year. I think Nick Collison was Bobby Knight one year and chucked a chair across the court or something like that. I mean, you know, those types of things were a lot more, I guess, real time maybe. They were right there in front of you, and so – it brought in that that aspect of, I don't know, improv a little bit. You know, you don't know how many times they had to do a certain take or refilm or whatever, re-record something when they're making those video productions. And that's, there's nothing wrong with that, but they're usually pretty flawless and they come off pretty clean. Whereas in front of a live audience, 16,000 people there watching you rattle off your top 10 list and chuck the card like Letterman used to do and all that stuff. I mean, you know, there was something, I don't know, something that maybe made a little bit more of a real connection between the event and the crowd. And I think that's been a little bit lost. It's not that they're less entertaining. I mean, the Devontae's thing between two hoops was hilarious. I love the Remember the Titans skit. I love the Wolf of Wall Street thing. I mean, I thought those were great. They just, that stuff used to happen right in front of you instead of on the video board. And I don't blame them. You know, use your video board. You've got the technology. You've got Rock Chalk Video that does a great job producing stuff. So, you know, why not do that? But it definitely takes some of the charm away. And I think you're right. I mean, I think the only place you go from here is maybe making it a little shorter. I think Bill Self mentioned that after. He said it was a little long for him. And I, you know, I think if you're not going to do those types of skits on the court and you're just going to keep it to the videos, I don't know that you need to traipse everybody out there for these weird dances. I don't know that the junior class needs to dance, and then the sophomore class needs to dance, and then the seniors need to dance. I mean, I don't think that needs to happen. You know, it didn't exactly happen that way this year, although I think it did with the women's team. So, you know, maybe trim it a little bit, but no complaints. I mean, I'm with you. I think it was as big and grand and exciting, and just it was a total party in there, and anybody that showed up definitely got their money's worth.
Okay, so tell me how this works when you're covering a Lil Yachty concert. Did it make you feel reinvigorated? Did it make you feel more youthful than you actually are, or did it have the adverse effect? Did it make you feel kind of old?
No, youthful, for sure.
Okay, good.
I was not looking forward to it just because we might have talked about it a little bit last week. When I checked out some of his work online, on YouTube or whatever, It was kind of, you know, I like rap a lot. It's nothing against the genre at all. I mean, I just wasn't that impressed with his stuff. I was like, how they're gonna bring this to the field house? Yeah. And then he absolutely killed it. I mean, he could not have been better, in my opinion. I thought the guy, his songs hit, They were terrific. They had the place going and jumping and bouncing, and he was a big part of that. He went into the crowd, as you know. He walked out along Crest Row. I mean, just the guy gave it all he had while he was there, and that's all you ask. I mean, the guy probably got paid handsomely to be there, and it was cool for him to show that he was actually enjoying being there and not just going through the motions.
Well, when you see a guy like that and like yourself, and a lot of people who are covering it, and I'm sure a lot of fans who were there who aren't necessarily in his age demo, you kind of see this and you go, okay, well, I'm not the intended audience, right? The intended audience is these players. The intended audience is these recruits. And that kind of speaks to the entirety of late night. Like, everything that late night is about is geared towards the players and geared towards the recruits. And while the fans show up and show out, they're more a part of the act than they are a part of the audience, right? Because when recruits see that these fans are showing up to a scrimmage and to a concert for nothing other than to just support their program and be a part of whatever has the name of Kansas basketball on it, like, that speaks volumes to these recruits. And you just see an event like that on Saturday, and you can count the programs across the country on one hand who can do something like that. And in the case of that, like, having a guy, an artist who these kids, like, they listen to and they look up to, like, it may seem trivial to guys like us and people who don't follow it, but those kids are going to go on a bunch of different recruiting visits, and they're not going to see anything like that anywhere else.
Totally agree. I mean, it's crazy to think that a kid's decision on where he's going to play his college basketball for a year or two or 4 years could come down to, well, I really like seeing Lil Yachty there. I thought that was awesome. But I think it could. I mean, maybe not in every instance, but I think in some cases that could end up being the deciding factor, or at least part of the deciding factor that leads the kid to pick Kansas. And so if that's the game, if that's what you have to do, then that's how you have to play it. I mean, I mean, Lil Yachty, as much as Bill Self admitted to being a fan and wanting to join his fan club and all that after the event, I'm sure beforehand he was like, who? Okay, sure. If that's what the kid's like, let's do it, you know? So it's just another indication of how on top of everything KU is. I mean, they know how to host kids. They know how to be relevant. They know how to make their program sing and buzz and pop on every level. It's not just about winning 30 games a year and making a run at the Final Four every year, which they do. It's about everything. It's about, again, making it relevant with people of all ages, really. I mean, that's the beauty of Kansas basketball, I think. As much as the older crowd sitting in there on Saturday night was probably not really feeling Lil Yachty, there's plenty of that thing and that whole event, I should say, that still celebrates the grand history of Kansas basketball and is something that those types of people can relate to too. So that's a perfect example. I mean, that's exactly what it's become in a nutshell, and I think that's where it's going to go. If anything, I think KU is going to just have to keep getting bigger with it. I mean, it's very well known that Drake ends up going to Kentucky a lot. That's his spot among probably 346 others. You know, kind of a bandwagon guy. That's his reputation. But he is a Kentucky guy. I mean, he sticks with them pretty well. So Tech Nine was nice. They did well to get a guy that people around here know. And now Lil Yachty was probably another step forward. I mean, that's more of a internationally known kind of guy. So the real thing is, you know, who's next year? I mean, that's the exciting part. I mean, it could be a real big name next year. And that's not to say that Lil Yachty's not, but you can definitely go another level or two, and it'll be interesting to see if that's what they choose to do or try to do.
We're talking to Matt Tate of the Lawrence Journal World here, New FM 101.7, 1320 KLWN. I'm not going to ask you about the scrimmage specifically because I am of the belief that nothing that happened at that scrimmage has any impact on this season whatsoever. But with that being said, I do think just watching them on the court, and you just kind of, your mind starts to race towards the season and what they're going to look like and how they're going to play. Billy Preston and LeGerald Vick seem to me to be the two most important guys on this team in terms of finding out what their identity is going to be, because With Preston, if he can be a guy who can be a low post threat, then all of a sudden you do have the luxury of playing the typical three out, two in look that Bill Self has pretty much utilized the entirety of his career other than the last couple of seasons. If that doesn't work, then you have to count on LeGerald Vick to be that stretch four. Can he replicate in any way what Josh Jackson did a year ago, guarding the other guys four and still being that athletic wing-type player? I really do look at those two guys as being important in terms of finding out what this team's identity is going to be.
Well, there's no doubt. And you saw that out there during the scrimmage. I mean, even though it wasn't an indication of how they're going to play or what they're going to do or anything like that, I think you could see the potential for both of those guys. I mean, Billy Preston looked pretty comfortable. He's got a lot of work to do to be able to play for Bill Self, to be able to play the way that Self wants him to play, not only where but how and all of that. But the LeGerald Vick was absolutely the guy that stole the show for me. And I thought Devontae Graham was terrific and really had a big, like, hey, it's my senior year, let's do this type of moment. But Vick was electric. I mean, he's so aggressive. He's so fast. He's so long. There's so many things to like about his game. He showed a pull-up game that was pretty smooth. His three-point shot looks good, maybe better than ever. This is a guy that's just continuing to get better, you know, day after day after day after day. And now that he's a junior and he's got a couple of those, you know, the first 2 years under his belt, the harder years, so to speak, I think nothing but big things are ahead for him. So whether he can be or needs to be the type of guy that Josh Jackson was last year, I think is a little bit irrelevant. I mean, even though they may have to play small, I don't think you'll be talking about playing and replicating exactly what last year did. Number one, they don't have a Frank Mason, so it's, you're asking to do something that's probably not doable if that's the path you take it. So I think they'll find their own identity with it. I think if they have to go small, I think they'll go faster if that's even possible. I mean, last year's team loved to run, but I think even faster with this group. And I think, you know, nobody's going to beat Josh Jackson. That's just not how it works. I mean, that guy was he was so talented and he was so skilled and he was so versatile. But I think the combination of Vick and Svi and Marcus Garrett, even, you know, if those three have to sort of team up and kind of play that spot where they each do it for a few minutes a game or whatever, I think that's doable. I mean, again, neither one of those guys is as individually skilled and talented as Jackson, just on an individual level. But collectively, I think they can team together and kind of hold down that spot if need be, and kind of play the hot hand and play who matches up better and those types of things. So,
well, the only reason I reference Jackson is because the reason why it worked last year is because Jackson could defend the four and he could rebound the four. And with right. Vick, he doesn't have to be Jackson, but he has to do those two things, right? And if he can't,
Good point.
Billy Preston has to come in and be that guy.
Right. Yeah, there's no question. I mean, you could say all you want about LeGerald Vick and his offensive game, like I've done already. but the key for him will really be there on the glass, on the defensive end. He doesn't have to stop, you know, the 7 foot center from Baylor. I mean, he doesn't have to do that like Josh was able to
right.
do, but he does have to hit the glass. He does have to be a guy that you notice on the defensive end. And he should be, he's long, he's athletic. He can leap. I mean, he should be able to hit the glass. He should be able to alter shots. He should be able to at least be a guy you notice on that end. And so, right. Yeah. You're like you're saying, you don't need him to be Josh Jackson, but you need him to do Josh Jackson type duties. And I think he can, and I think he will. I can't say it enough. I've written it a few times. I've probably said it a few times already today. I mean, I just can't say enough about how high the ceiling is for Vick, and not just, you know, for the rest of his life or career or whatever. I think this year, I think he could have just an incredible jump and be one of the better players in the country, really. I mean, he's got so many things going for him, and he's got such a great opportunity to play for a coach that's going to let him do that and you know, play to his strengths and let him have some freedom to go be as good as he can be. So, yeah, I think he'll be fun to watch, and And Preston, like you said, I mean, that's he in so many ways is the real key to this team. I mean, if he can develop to their satisfaction, even just, you know, enough, then I think they've got a chance to be really, really good. If he's a guy more like a Sheck Diallo or a Cliff Alexander or a Kelly Oubre the first half of his freshman year, if he's one of those types of guys where they're just constantly fighting it and struggling to feel comfortable and to look comfortable and to adjust to what the coaches want, and if it's just one of those headache things, then you know, it's a different team, it's a different season, and they'll have to figure it out from there. But his body, his length, his ability, man, he looks so freaking intimidating and menacing. I would not want to match up with him. If he can somehow find that gear, the Josh Jackson mentality, you know, I mean, just that absolute dog mentality where you're just going to lay it on the line every possession and compete your face off and nothing else matters to you but that moment. If Preston can even approach that, they'll take whatever they can get out of that, because that's so much or so often the key is just playing with that right mindset and that mentality. And if he does that, all those physical tools that he has will just sort of fall in place and kind of follow and inevitably lead to good things.
I don't see a way in which, regardless of what you think about him or what you think his ceiling is or how much he should be utilized, I don't see a way in which Mitch Lightfoot doesn't play a pretty significant role in this team as well, simply because you can't get through a year with only two big guys, whether you're playing small or big. Like, he's going to have to play significant minutes for this team.
Yeah, he will. And we talked about this yesterday on our KU Sports Hour podcast, which was the first time I'd really thought about this. It's online now, and it's kind of fun, but I'll give you the gist. Basically, you know, Mitch Lightfoot was told at the beginning of the summer or after the season that one thing that would really benefit him and the team is that if he could find a way to develop an outside shot, if he could be a little bit of a stretch 4-2. You've got all these guards, all this athleticism. Let's see if you can extend your range and keep things open on the offensive end for the rest of those guys to do their thing. And so he went to work, man, and he took probably 400,000 jumpers a day and developed his shot and was having some success with it. And, you know, early morning, 6 a.m. shooting, after school. Well, he did it at his high school a lot back in Arizona. So after their school, you know, going back to the gym and shooting another bunch of jumpers. And, you know, the guy really, really spent a good chunk of this offseason working on that skill. Well, that's great. And I don't doubt that Mitch Lightfoot probably is a better shooter today than he was 6 months ago. But he's still not going to be a guy that you really need out there to take a bunch of jumpers. We've seen it. In Italy, he struggled. He didn't make very many. Just the other night, even in the scrimmage, he had a couple that just didn't look great. One got blocked. I mean, it's a little bit slow still with that release. So, you know, he's going to have to learn that after spending 3-4 months of just thinking offense, he needs to get back to what he really should be focusing on, which is rebounding, garbage points, you know, toughness, just doing every little thing you can while you're on the floor to make an impact. Because the reality is he's never going to be better than the fifth option offensively when he's on the floor. So it's great that he tried to do that. It's great that he spent the time and put the effort in and put the hours in to improve and advance his offensive game. But he needs to quickly realize that, hey, this offensive thing, while it's nice and maybe it can be gravy for me and my team, where I'm going to make my money is hustle points, using my athleticism to grab a couple of offensive boards a game, being as tough as I can on the defensive end. I mean, that's where he's going to have to go. And the parallel that was drawn on our podcast that I hadn't really thought about was, if you think back to Landon Lucas at the beginning of last year, it was a very similar thing. Landon Lucas, because he was going to be a senior, because he had a chance to have a bigger role, because he had aspirations of playing professionally and possibly even in the NBA, he spent a good chunk of his offseason leading up to his senior year working on his offensive game, post moves, his jump shot. I mean, trying to do as many things as he could to make himself a better offensive player. When the season rolled around and they're in Honolulu playing Indiana and they're in New York playing Duke, And you know, it's go time. So he's out there trying to do all these things that he's not supposed to do. And that's not to say he didn't get better, and that's not to say that he doesn't deserve a lot of credit for working on those things, but it wasn't him. And it wasn't the Landon Lucas that KU basketball needed him to be. He figured it out after a short period of adjustment and things like that. And then he went on to have a monster senior year and was as good as anybody has ever seen him. So I think there is a parallel there, and I think that if Lightfoot could just kind of get hip to that and understand that today, it might help him get closer when, you know, mid-November rolls around by the time they are playing Kentucky in Chicago. You know, maybe he's a little bit better off and trying to be more of what they need him to be, which is probably a lot more like a guy like Damari Traylor or something like that than it is a guy like Perry Ellis or Josh Jackson.
He's Matt Tate. You can check out all of his work in the Lawrence Journal World at KUSports.com. Thanks again, man.
My pleasure. Thanks, Nick.
All righty, that's Matt Tate. I'm Nick Schwartz, Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. We'll dive into the audio fun bag coming up later in the 4 o'clock hour. We'll have another edition of Let's Rank Stuff as well. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Let's Rank Stuff coming up in 20 minutes. Kevin Flaherty of 24/7 Sports joins us at 5 o'clock. I'm Nick Schwert. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk. New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Let's go ahead and jump into the Tuesday news break. And it pains me to talk about Kentucky basketball and their fans because it's just... Like, and the whole debate over, like, who has the best fans in America, like, that is so exhausting to me. It is, I hate that in every sport, but in college basketball, it hits a little closer to home. And I'm not saying this as a slight, I'm just saying this as a fact, because you cannot argue it, okay? Fans in about a 60-mile radius from this area, everyone thinks they have the best fans. Royals fans, they're the most dedicated. Chiefs fans, they're the loudest. KU fans are the most passionate, right? Like, that's just how it is around here, and that's fine. I'm not going to argue with any of it, but that's just the way it is. Kentucky fans are the same way, and I hate to break it to you, but you cannot top the level of passion that Kentucky fans have. And the reason why that is, and you shouldn't take it as a slight at all, is because it's unhealthy. It's unhealthy how passionate Kentucky fans are about their basketball program. Because think about it. When KU basketball is not playing, and when it's the summer, oh, you've got the Royals. In the fall, you've got Chiefs football. You have things to occupy your time. Kentucky fans don't have a professional baseball team. They don't have a professional football team. They don't have a professional basketball team. Kentucky fans only have Kentucky basketball. That is it. So in the summer, when you're talking about the Royals and the trade deadline and making a playoff push, free agency, whatever, Kentucky fans are talking about Kentucky basketball. It's all they do all year long. It's very unhealthy. It's a very unhealthy relationship they have with their basketball program. So much so that when their season ended last year, questionable calls, John Calipari called out the refereeing afterwards. Well, one of the guys, a very familiar name around these parts, who was refereeing that game was John Higgins. And we talked about this story when it broke, the fact that Kentucky fans were going on Higgins' professional website because he owns a roofing company in Nebraska. It's called Rooferees, Rooferees.com, Rooferees. And he went on their, the Kentucky fans went on their Facebook page and they were just leaving these very crude, crass reviews, like just negative reviews. Some of them tried to act like they were serious, but a lot of them made it very clear that they were giving a poor review because of the way that John Higgins refereed the Kentucky game in which they inevitably lost. And he had to shut down the business phone. They essentially shut down the company because of all of the bad negative reviews that were coming in. People were calling, leaving death threats at his home, which again... Like, once you get, I mean, even once you're giving the company negative reviews, you've taken it too far. When you're calling in death threats, well, clearly you've taken it too far. It's against the law. Like, right? I don't need to come up and take a moral high ground on that. Like, you can't do it. It's against the law. You're not supposed to do it. Well, Kentucky Sports Radio, hosted by Matt Jones, he's come on the show a couple of times. It's huge in Kentucky. It's the biggest radio program, period, in the state of Kentucky. They've got like 100 affiliates all across the state. And John Higgins is suing them. He just filed a lawsuit earlier today suing them, alleging intentional infliction of emotional distress, invasion of privacy, tortious interference with a business, and civil conspiracy. It calls for an award of damage in excess of $75,000. Matt Jones has come on the show. He is explicitly listed in this lawsuit. I would normally say John Higgins has no, you're not going to win this. Like, how are you going to prove that Kentucky fans like actually caused you to lose $75,000 in business or emotional distress, whatever the case may be? Normally I would take that stance, but it's really hard for me to take the side of Kentucky basketball fans because they are crazy, dude. They are absolutely a loony bunch. I don't know how this is going to work, but I'll say one thing. John Higgins can never referee a Kentucky game again, right?
No, especially not in Lexington.
What do you think would happen? Like, he'd get booed the whole game, but, I mean, that's what refs sign up for that. Like, John Higgins is not popular amongst KU fans, but he's not fearing for his safety when he comes to Allen Fieldhouse.
Yeah, I mean, and once he leaves Allen Fieldhouse, if you spot John Higgins on Mass Street, like, you're not going to go up to him and do something or say something. I think I would be worried about that if you were in Lexington.
Really, though? Do you think somebody would physically assault him?
No, I'm not saying necessarily would, like, beat him up, but would you be surprised if somebody went up to him and tried to start, like, a verbal altercation?
If you're yelling, no. And, like, it would go beyond booing if he were actually in the arena, right? Like, people would be yelling expletives at him. Bleep you. You bleeping suck. And if you're yelling that even now at any referee, you need, like, go home and look in the mirror. Go home and look in the mirror and ask, like, okay, who am I? What is my code in life? What code do I live by? Do I live by a code that says it is perfectly acceptable to go to a sporting event and scream at the referee? Like, I understand booing. Whatever. I don't agree with it. I don't think I've ever booed. I don't think I've ever sat at a game and did this. Because booing sounds fine if you are amongst the crowd. It's one of those things, right? Where if you are one of 100 doing it, it's fine. But if you really want to put it into context, like what booing is, you need to do it by yourself. Do it by yourself and then tell me how you think it sounds, okay? I'll give you an example right now. How does it sound when I do this, Derek? Boo! Boo!
I'm going to go the other way.
Does that sound like a respectable thing to do?
I think we need more booing in life. I think if you're at a meeting, you're at a company presentation, you don't like it, I think you just need to start booing. I think if you don't like your food, you start booing at the waitress.
No, it's the most uncivilized way to express your feelings. And I get that. There's not a lot of civility when it comes to being a fanatic, right? Like, you're not going to sit up there in the stands and go, sir, I vehemently disagree with that call. Would you mind if we could have a discussion about this after the game? Like, that's not going to work either. But there has to be a fine line. Like, do you think sporting events would be weird if fans just didn't boo ever? If they just never booed?
No, I don't think that would be weird. I'm sure that happens plenty of places.
No, it does not. No, it does not. If we're talking professional sports, there is not one game in the last 100 years that has not involved fans booing. I wonder what the first boo was. Probably had to be like Renaissance times, right? Like booing at a king?
A bad jouster?
A bad jester, I think is what you're looking at.
No, like the guys with the...
I was thinking of like the court jester. Like you boo the court jester.
Maybe that
and then,
too.
Then you decapitate him, right? But like think about that. If a common practice was invented 30 years ago, 40 years ago to display your displeasure, should we still be utilizing it in modern times? Like, to me, booing is one of the most archaic ways to display your emotions, and I, for the life of me, cannot understand why we still do it.
It's kind of similar if you were to, like, take a bite of food and just be like, yuck! Right?
You get a pizza for the table. Yeah, and everybody hates it, and then everybody's just at the table is just screaming, yuck. Yuck! Yuck! Ooh! Ooh! Who would do that? And the answer is nobody. The answer is nobody would do that because it's not civilized and you would embarrass yourself and everybody else at the table. But you go to a sporting event and you just scream boo with no disregard, no remorse, when it's just the most shameful thing you could ever do. It really is, man. It really is. And I do not think it at all, I don't think it at all contributes to a better environment for games. Like, you're not less of a fan. You're not worse fans if you guys don't boo. You know? Are you less of a food critic if you don't scream yuck at the table? Yucky! Ew! And you're, like, scraping your tongue off at the table. Ugh! Oh! Because nobody does that. Because it's a terrible thing to do. It's terrible. Booing is terrible. I do love that we have universally in the sports world accepted the fact that at sporting events, if you're the home team, you're the home crowd, replay review, after reviewing the play, the ruling on the field is reversed and it goes against your team. It doesn't matter. It does not matter if it is like concrete, inarguable evidence. The home fans, they will rain down on you with boos. And we have just accepted that, yep, that's okay. We're going to boo no matter what at home. Like, it could be the most obvious overturn call ever in the history of sports. The fans will unanimously boo. Not a couple of them. Everyone will boo that call. And we've just accepted that as being okay.
I think we could make a fantastic Let's Rank Stuff out of things that fans boo, like the worst things that they boo. Pickoffs at first base.
Oh, yeah. You're wasting
every
our time.
Time.
How about mound visits?
Yeah.
Well, baseball, it's funny. It's they're specific to sports. Like, baseball will view anything that constitutes you wasting our time. Right? Like, if a guy fouls off, like, six pitches in a row, we'll start booing. We're going to start booing that.
Draws on third down.
Oh, yeah. If you run it on third down, like, third and seven, and you call a run play that goes for 3 yards up the gut, oh, my gosh. You are the worst coach in the world. Check downs on third down. Yeah, dude. Booing is just such a weird thing. It's a weird phenomenon. I don't know if I've ever booed. I don't think I've ever, like, consciously went to a sporting event and decided, like, you know what? That's worthy of a boo. You know what's cool? Cheering. You know what's okay to do? Clapping, because it's civilized. Booing is, it's caveman behavior. It is, seriously, it's just like a grunt. You know what I mean? That's what booing is. It's an inaudible, like, babies could boo. Think about that. Babies. Babies can boo. That's probably one of the first sounds a baby can make, you know? You just, like, you don't have any, you have a very tenuous grasp of the English language, and you're just making sounds, whatever comes out of your body involuntarily. That's what booing is. And people do that. And I just don't understand it. Well, I think that's about it for the news break. I think we'll go ahead and wrap it up there. We'll end on a
very
high note.
Hard newsy.
It was one story about John Higgins and my general philosophy on the art of booing. It's 4:38 on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Up next, Let's Rank Stuff.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
About a quarter till 5 on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. With Derek Johnson, I'm Nick Schwert. We'll talk to Kevin Flaherty of 24/7 Sports coming up at the top of the 5 o'clock hour. Talk some Big 12 football with our guy Kevin Flaherty. But right now, it's time for another edition of the most self-explanatory segment in the history of sports talk radio. It is time for Let's Rank Stuff. And Derek, dare I say, this edition of Let's Rank Stuff will be the most daring, the most polarizing, the most controversial Let's Rank Stuff that we've ever done. And we've done a lot of them. that have pushed the boundaries of what is suitable for radio airwaves. And I think today we are pushing that to the next level. Today's edition of Let's Rank Stuff. Things that science needs to hurry up with. I couldn't come up with a better title than that. And I'm actually quite satisfied with that title. So I will not be taking suggestions on what to change that. Things that science needs to hurry up with. I have decided that we will be taking all diseases off the board. Because if diseases were eligible for this list, 1 through 10 would be diseases. And that's not quite as fun of a list. So things that science needs to hurry up with, diseases are exempt. Number 10, the robot butler. Ever since watching Jetsons as a kid, it wasn't really a robot butler. It was more of a
robot maid, correct?
Robot maid. Do we know her name?
Ooh.
Astro was the dog. Rosie. It was Rosie. Rosie the robot maid. Now, pretty much all inventions in life are just to make things easier or to make things better. This is one of the inventions that would just make things easier. Having a robot butler to do all of your household chores for you, I think it would have to be an 18 and over sort of product because we need kids to learn values and hard work and stuff like that. But once you hit 18, you don't have to work hard anymore, right? That's kind of my general philosophy.
So, like, once you turn 18, instead of getting, like, a car or maybe some money from the parents, you just get a robot butler.
Now you have to live by yourself, too. You have to be financially independent. But imagine having a robot butler for like 5 years, and then you and I are talking, and you don't have a robot butler, and you're talking about doing your laundry or doing the dishes. Like, what kind of dishwasher soap do you use? And I go, I don't know. I haven't done dishes in 5 years. I haven't done my laundry in 5 years. My robot butler does it for me. You know how great that would be? Think about all of the time that you would save if you didn't have to do dishes, if you didn't have to do laundry, if you didn't have to cook your own meals. Now, the robot butler has to be confined to the house, right? He's not going out and doing errands for you. He can't go pick up your dry cleaning. He can't go pick up your groceries. He can't go wash the car for you. It has to be stuff that is only confined to the house. Cleaning the house, cleaning the clothes, cleaning the dishes. It'd pretty much just be a cleaner, right? A robot cleaner, which is fine because that's the stuff that nobody likes to do.
That said, I know that you're someone who gets concerned about technology overload to where it becomes a problem like Terminator or something.
Yeah.
Are you worried at all that that would happen with this?
No, because he would have a very select number of tasks that he can do. Like if he can't drive a car, then I'm not really worried about him, right?
What if he teaches himself to?
No, he's not going to be that advanced of a robot. That's what I'm saying. He's not going to have this supercomputer inside of him. It's going to be like a Roomba, right? It's a Roomba that an advanced Roomba. That's the thing. If we've developed the technology to have robots to vacuum our carpet and pick up crumbs, would it be that hard to find a robot that could clean the dishes for you? That could cook some spaghetti? I don't think so. And I'm perfectly fine with that. Number 9, limitless phone batteries. This one kind of goes without saying. We absolutely have the technology for that. A battery that never needs to be charged. Why do we have a battery that lasts years in a car that can drive hundreds and thousands of miles, but my iPhone battery only lasts for 8 hours?
Well, I think they actually do have this available. I actually wouldn't be surprised if they have like limitless batteries just in general, like instead of AAA or AA. I think they hide it from people because they know, you may have to pay more for it, but in the long run, you're going to have to pay more buying a bunch of six-packs of AAAs. Or you're going to have to pay a bunch more having to charge your phone from the energy companies.
Yep.
It's all about the money.
I agree. That's why iPhone, like every time they come out with a new iPhone, Apple, they have like one feature that's not that overwhelming. They have tons of technology that they're just saving, but they want you to continue buying new phones and continue spending money every time they come out with a new one. Number 8. On things that science needs to hurry up with, ordering apps at restaurants and bars.
I'm assuming by apps you do not mean appetizers.
No, an application on your phone. We've all been to the bar. There's 12 people up there. There's one bartender. You're trying to get their attention. What if we all just had an app on our phone? We tell them what we want in it. It pops up on a little machine. They don't have to worry. You don't have to worry about them choosing the hot chick over you, right? You don't have to worry about yourself because you're standing in the back and he can't see you. He's not looking at your end of the bar. You order it, you wait in line, take a ticket, whatever the case may be, and then your drink is delivered to you when it's ready. Same thing with food. Where's our waitress been? I need more water. oh, she's confused. She's writing down all of these different orders. You've got a table of eight, and you've all got special orders. You don't want this. You do want that. Extra this, extra that. Put it all in the app. You don't have to worry about miscommunication. You don't have to worry about your waiter or waitress isn't giving you enough attention. All of it's on the app, man. It simplifies the restaurant experience.
That just got me thinking, like, what that would be like. Let's say that's 20 years in the future. It's been going on for 20 years. So all of a sudden we get in the future. We think of diners now as, like, something, a 50s, 60s restaurant. Maybe if, like, diners transition. So by the time all the places you go to eat, you're ordering on an app. But then they have, like, old-timey restaurants where you don't order on an app and you're, like, taking your kids
like
there.
Like a throwback.
Yeah. Yeah, we used to have to not order our food on an app. We have to talk to the waitress.
That's an interesting theory, and it's one that will pop up later on the list, and I can't wait to get to that. Number seven, how about this? This is you don't really need this if you have the robot butler, but maybe in the meantime, until we get the robot butler up and going, this is a very specific invention. A clothes hamper that doubles as a washer and a dryer, right? You throw your clothes in the dirty hamper, it gets full. 2 hours later, you've got clean clothes.
I would take it further. It folds them as well.
Now I think you're getting pushing the boundaries of modern technology a little bit.
Oh, now
I don't, and I think this is doable. I think this is doable. It's just like a container. It fills up with clothes. Once it reaches a certain level, it automatically starts filling up with water, washes your clothes. The water drains out. All of a sudden, it turns into a dryer. Why do we need two separate machines for a washer and a dryer? It seems like they always look exactly the same. Can't we just put all that technology into one box?
I think that would be the greatest invention in the 21st century.
I would tend to agree. Other than this, at number six, things that science needs to hurry up with, animal translators. Specifically, dog translators. Now, maybe I'm pushing, maybe I'm getting a little too ambitious here, thinking that we have the technology to translate dogs' thoughts and barks into human sounds. But can you imagine? Do you think you'd like that? You have a dog, right? Do you think you'd like that? Because we love, here's the thing about dogs. We love all dogs, right? And if you don't like dogs, if you abuse dogs, you are scum of the earth. We hate you because how could you ever hurt an innocent dog? Well, what if dogs are able to start voicing their opinions and thoughts? And maybe not all dogs are great. Maybe you get to know your dog that you've loved for 7 years and you're like, oh my gosh, my dog is an absolute jerk.
Well, plus everyone loves doing that thing when their dog does something funny or when their dog does something cute, and then somebody will be like, oh, they're just doing this, and then somebody will voice what the dog should be saying or like what the dog was thinking there.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think people like doing that.
Right. But here's the question. If we can hear dog's thoughts, does that mean they can understand ours?
I don't know if I like this.
I still don't know if there'd be an open line of communication. I think you'd find out that your dog is a terrible dog, and then you just take the voice translator off. And let's just go back to me pretending that you're just the nicest, warmest, cuddliest, furriest little thing in the world. All right, we're into the top five things that science needs to hurry up with. Number five, an ointment for your tongue and your mouth. We have Neosporin. We have all kinds of topical lotions and ointments and creams and gels that we can put on the outside of our body to fix burns, cuts, bruises, scabs, pimples, whatever. We don't have any of that stuff for the inside of your mouth. We've all bit our tongue. We've all burned the roof of our mouth. We've all had canker sores on our cheeks. And what do you do when those happen? You just wait them out. And you know what? Sometimes they're a real beating. If you have one of those little canker sores on the side of your tongue and it's brushing up against your teeth all day, it's terrible. Why don't we have ointments for the inside of the mouth? It doesn't seem like something that could be that hard. We have body lotion that's edible. You have moisturizer that you can put in your mouth. Well, then why can't we have ointment that you can put in your mouth too? Make it taste good. Make it taste like cinnamon. Make it taste like cookie dough. Make it taste like peppermint. I don't care. We absolutely have the technology to do this. Why we haven't yet is absurd to me. Do you know anything about the anatomy of the inside of the mouth?
Nothing.
Number four. This one, We're taking steps in that direction. We're not there yet. Fingerprint everything, man. There should be only one way to access any and all of your belongings, and it should be your fingerprint.
I don't like this. Do you have the fingerprint on your iPhone?
Yes.
How often does it work?
Like 100% of the time.
Really? For me, it's like 25%.
But you've got those giant caveman behemoth hands.
So I don't like this then. You're segregating us big hand people.
Well, we can create fingerprints for sausage fingers like you and David Lawrence. All right? That's fine. But, I mean, I'm saying your car should be only one way to get into your car, fingerprint. Nobody can steal your keys and steal your car. Your credit cards. No more PIN numbers. No more whatever security questions. No, your fingerprint. Your bank account, online information, fingerprint. There has to be a fingerprint scan on every single computer, every single device that you have. Your house. No more house keys. Nobody can steal your house and get into your house. Got to have a fingerprint scan to get in your house. It would secure everything. Yahoo just broke this news an hour ago. That when they had their hack back in 2013 or whenever that was, literally every single user of Yahoo was... their information was hacked into. You know how much that is? You know how much many people that is? 3 billion people. That's half the planet. Guess what wouldn't have happened if you had fingerprint technology? Any of it. Because they wouldn't have been able to hack it because they don't have 3 billion fingerprints. I'm telling you, this is the way to go. If you want to change it to eye scanning, you know, like they have in the James Bond movies where they scan his eyeball, his retina, that's perfectly fine too. I will succumb to that. All right, we're into the top three of things that science needs to hurry up with already. Number three, dream trackers.
Love it.
Every single human on the face of this planet has spent copious amounts of time trying to figure out exactly what that dream was all about last night.
Just imagine if it would be like a DVR. Could go back the next day, put it on a TV, a projector, fast forward, rewind, whatever.
Do you think it would be more of a time waste than anything else?
Probably, because you're dreaming for 8 hours.
The dream tracker would come with a dream. No, you're not. You're not. That's a false. You're only dreaming towards the tail end of your sleep cycle. You have to be asleep for 4 hours till you start dreaming to have those vivid dreams when you get into REM sleep. And that's when the real cool stuff starts to happen. Because there's no way those dreams are just meaningless, right? There's no way they're just a collection of your thoughts mishmashed into an incoherent, you know, little 30-minute segment while you're sleeping. There's no way. They have significant meaning. What about when you have deja vu and you're like, oh my gosh, I dreamed that? What if our dreams unlock the key to, like, the real power of the human brain and we just haven't been able to figure it out? There has to be a way to put, like, a tracking device on our dreams and then be able to translate it when we wake up. Every single human, everybody wants to know what their dreams mean. We need a dream tracker in order to figure that out. Number two, driverless cars. We're starting to make some progress in that direction, but we need to get this figured out. Okay, because you mentioned, like, if we had apps and then robot servers at restaurants and we're taking our kids out 20 years from now and that's the norm for them, and then you take them to a restaurant with actual human servers and they're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you guys used to do this. I think 50 years from now, that is going to be the prevailing sentiment from our children is, I can't believe that you used to be able to be allowed to drive cars. Because regardless of how often you get into a wreck or how often you have been injured in a car accident, the numbers would bear out that humans are not good at driving. We get in wrecks every single day. Hundreds of thousands of people die every year from car accidents. If we can get the technology to make all cars driverless to the point where nobody gets into car wrecks, nobody speeds, nobody gets caught in traffic jams, nobody dies in car accidents, our kids are going to look back on it and say, how did they ever let you drive cars? The same way we look back on it and say, how were you ever allowed to smoke on an airplane? Like, why was that ever something that we thought was okay? That's how we're going to look back on us driving cars. Because 50 years from now, every car is going to be driverless and it's just going to be perfect, right? Cars are communicating. There's a magnet. I don't know how this works. Here's my technology, though. You have computer chips in the roads, in every road. There's computer chips in your car and the car and every other car. So constantly, Like, your car is communicating with the road, who's communicating with the car in front of you. So it's just free-flowing traffic constantly. No traffic stops, no stoplights. Every single car is just moving just fluidly throughout the streets. It's going to be perfect. It's going to be beautiful. All right, number one, things that science needs to hurry up with, baldness. Are you kidding me? How have we not figured this out? How have we not figured out how to stop hair from dissipating on the top of your head and how to figure out, okay, here's the way that you can have a full head of hair. Oh, you can't grow facial hair? Here's a solution. Here's a little pill you take. Now you can grow whatever kind of hair you want. Go onto a computer, pick your hairstyle out. Go onto a computer, pick your mustache out. Whatever. We should be able to figure this out by now. There's no way. I mean, all this other stuff, maybe a little bit down the line, we have to have the technology to figure out baldness. Science, you need to hurry up with that already. And that's Let's Rank Stuff. I'm Nick Schwert with Derek Johnson. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Kevin Flaherty joins us next.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
5 o'clock hour here, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. I am Nick Schwert with Derek Johnson. Happy to have you with us on a lovely Tuesday afternoon. 1 hour left in the show. We'll get to some more college basketball talk coming up here about 15 minutes from now. But right now, we welcome on our good friend from 24/7 Sports, Kevin Flaherty, back onto the program. Kevin, we didn't talk last week, so a lot's kind of gone down in the conference over the last couple of weeks. TCU beating Oklahoma State, probably chief amongst them. Are you buying into TCU being a serious contender in this conference?
You know, TCU is one of those teams that typically plays Oklahoma State really well. And I think that a lot of that is, you know, they say that styles make fights, you know, in the boxing world. And a lot of that's true in college basketball and college football as well. And in college football, you know, one of the best people in the country at defending spread offenses is Gary Patterson. His system is sort of tailor-made for it. He built that defense that way. And it's really fascinating to hear him talk about the why they do the different things that they do. But even beyond that, though, I thought it was a really great showing for TCU. You know, they looked really good offensively. They got a pretty good performance out of Kenny Hill. Obviously, they ran the ball incredibly well. And so, yeah, I think at this point you have to buy into TCU as maybe the second-best team in the conference, especially given that, one, they beat the team that most people thought was either first or second in the conference. But even beyond that, the team that a lot of us, myself included, had as sort of that number three team, I mean, Kansas State hasn't really looked like the Kansas State that we thought they would be at this point. And so, yeah, I think you have to buy into TCU as one of the league's better teams at this point.
Yeah, I think we talked after like week two, and I feel like a donkey now, but I came on and I was telling you how, isn't this kind of the type of Kansas State team that just lulls people to sleep all year long, but then we wind up at the end of the year and they're in the top 10 in the hunt for the college football playoff? Yeah, that's not going to happen with the Wildcats, is it?
No, and the funny thing is, you know, it's been a lot of issues on offense, and most of us felt like with them returning the 10 starters on offense, you know, they were adding Carlos Strickland, who is a former four-star recruit, you know, who was a 6'4", 6'5" wide receiver coming back from Cal. They were returning Alex Barnes, who really emerged at the end of last year as their running back. And so most of us really felt like offensively, you know, Kansas State, shockingly enough, because of how they've been recently, was going to be pretty dynamic. And instead, you know, if you've watched their last few games, they weren't really able to win the point of attack against Vanderbilt. And they've had wide receivers dropping passes quite a bit, and they've had some issues throwing the ball as well. And so that next step offensively that most of us felt like they were going to take this year, they haven't taken. And the flip side of that is the defense has maybe been a little bit better than a lot of us thought it would be, especially after losing a high draft pick and everything. But yeah, I don't think K-State is at the point, at least, you know, at this point in the season, that most of us felt like they were going to be at. And that's that's kind of an interesting thing to watch, I think, as this conference season plays out. Is just how good is Kansas State? Are they going to be a team that's going to beat everybody by 7 points, and we still look at them at the end of the year and they're 9-3, and you say, okay, well, they kind of did what we thought they would do, or are they going to be a team that's going to struggle a little bit more and maybe be closer down to 7-5 and 6-6?
You think it's more likely for K-State to finish in the top three or the bottom three of the Big 12?
I don't think they're bottom three. I think it's more likely for them to be in the top three. But at the same time, you know, I do think it's an interesting question, just because I think the Big 12 is so much deeper than all of us thought heading into the season. And certainly I remember, you know, talking with you on your show and being 100% wrong, at least at this point, about how good I thought Texas Tech was going to be. You know, I thought Texas Tech was going to be the type of team this year that was going to have Cliff Kingsbury, if not already ejected from his hot seat, then certainly well on the way to being fired, you know, through 6 or 8 games a season. And obviously that just hasn't been the case. And so when you're talking about the bottom of the league and you're seeing Baylor improve on a week-to-week basis and Iowa State being what they are, I do think that the bottom of the league is significantly better than maybe it has been in recent years.
Well, whether we're talking about Kansas State, you know, winning a close one against Baylor, or Texas Tech, you know, almost pulling the upset off against Oklahoma State, like, I hate that with the perception of the Big 12, nationally speaking, like, it's a lose-lose situation regardless of how you want to look at it. Like, if we look at that Texas Tech-Oklahoma State game, we say, man, Oklahoma State lost to TCU, and then you only beat Texas Tech by 7. Like, maybe, I mean, we don't think Texas Tech is very good, so maybe Oklahoma State's not as good as we thought. Or on the flip side of things, maybe we could just sit here and say, well, maybe Texas Tech's just better than we thought. But in the Big 12, in the way that they're perceived nationally, and a lot of times in college football, perception can be reality, especially when it comes to people in a room deciding who's going to be in that playoff. That's the kind of stuff that we deal with every year, and it just, you can already kind of see those storylines coming, you know, a month, 2 months down the road.
Sure, and it's tough for people who aren't familiar with the conference to make those sort of declarations. And it's not anything new. I mean,
no.
If you remember back to the Orange Bowl season, even, you know, what was the common cry against Kansas was, well, they haven't played anybody, they haven't beaten anybody, and yet Kansas, you know, went to Kansas State and beat a K-State team that lit up a 10-win Texas team in Austin.
Right.
And Kansas won on the road at Colorado, the exact same place that Oklahoma, which won the Big 12 that year, went to Colorado and lost. And so the argument was, well, Kansas hasn't beaten anybody. Where are the top 25 teams and things like that? Whereas if you're more familiar with the conference, you know that it's tough to go to Lubbock and win, you know, regardless of how good Texas Tech is in any given year. You understand that you're probably not, with where Iowa State is right now, going to blow Iowa State off the map. I mean, they're a team that's going to be very fundamental and difficult to beat. And the really funny thing about all this was, remember when Kansas State played Auburn 2 or 3 years ago? And it was a really close game that Auburn pulled out in Manhattan. I went on the Auburn board that week because they had asked somebody to give a Kansas State perspective. And, you know, so I talked to them about it, and I say Kansas State's going to slow down the tempo, and, of course, Auburn goes really fast with Gus Malzahn on, and it was going to be a close game, and I basically got, you know, 3,000 F-bombs all at the same time because, you know, these Auburn fans, they couldn't understand. Well, they said, we've got 4- and 5-star players. K-State's starting a bunch of walk-ons on their lineup. This isn't going to be a close game at all. And so I think that it's one of those things, it's really tough if you don't pay that much attention to a specific conference to sort of understand where the traps and the pitfalls are that can befall any team. And so you don't have an understanding or an appreciation for maybe the league being deeper than it really is.
We're talking to Kevin Flaherty of 24/7 Sports here, New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Texas has looked really good since that, well, at least their defense has looked really good since, you know, allowing Maryland to put up 40 on them back in week 1. In this conference with the spread offenses and knowing what has worked over the last couple of years, what is Texas capable of? What is their ceiling, knowing that they are led by a team where their strength is their defense?
You know, I think that their ceiling is such that I don't think Texas is in position to win the conference this year, and I think that they're also in a position where they could be put in some dangerous positions, maybe, that if the offense was a little bit better, they wouldn't be put in. You know, maybe the defense plays really well, but you find yourself in the fourth quarter of a 21-14 game against a team that really isn't, you know, a great, great team. And that's certainly possible with Texas this year. It wouldn't surprise me a bit to see a team like, say, a Texas Tech, for instance, that has been very good offensively and has shown more defensively than they have in recent years. If Texas Tech puts up 30 or 35 points on Texas, can Texas match it? And I think that's a very valid question at this point. And I think that, you know, the one thing that I've sort of been right on, I feel like, is I do think that Oklahoma is the class of the Big 12 this year. And Oklahoma has both the defense and the offense. And, you know, their defense, I think, is getting into a spot where the depth is rounding out a little bit. They're getting some guys off suspension and injury. And so when you look at that game in Red River just in 2 weeks, you know, which Texas, you would assume, would probably have to win if they want to sort of declare their intention to compete for the Big 12 title, it's hard to see them winning that game, just in that if Oklahoma and Baker Mayfield score 25 or 30 points, which you can guess that they probably will, because that's a really good offense. Can Texas keep up? I don't see it at this point, but it could be a different story by the end of the year. You know, they're still such a young team in a lot of places, and it's hard to believe, but I mean, they almost beat USC at USC with the true freshman quarterback, and their starting quarterback is just a sophomore. So as that position improves, maybe Texas will get sort of that punter's chance to make a run at the league title by the end of the year.
We talked early in the season, and I remember you weren't supremely optimistic in Oklahoma State's chances of being a legitimate college football playoff contender. Now that they lose that game to TCU, I mean, do you see their chances as being completely shot at this point?
I wouldn't say completely shot, but I think they're hanging on life support at this point. It was the reason that I thought that Oklahoma State probably wouldn't quite get there was because I felt like Oklahoma was better, and I felt like the way that the season would play out, if Oklahoma State was going to get to the college football playoff, they would have to beat Oklahoma twice to do it. And now that's 100% certainty, pretty much, unless Oklahoma just nosedives, which none of us see happening. So it's a situation where Oklahoma State can't afford to lose again. They aren't going to make the college football playoff with two losses. And so if they run that table, that means they're going to have to go ahead and they're going to have to beat Oklahoma, and they're probably going to have to beat Oklahoma again the very next week, or even beat TCU the very next week to win the conference. And that's something that just at this point it seems like probably won't happen.
How much are their chances, in your mind, tied to what TCU does the rest of the year? Just looking at what the committee has shown they value and what they don't necessarily care about. TCU right now a top 10 team, and if they continue winning, that loss at the end of the year may not look like a bad one. All of a sudden, though, if TCU gets a loss here, a loss there, they end the season at 9-3, that could hurt their chances a little bit. So how much are they directly tied to what TCU does the rest of the year?
You know, I don't know that they're that tied, just in that they need TCU to start losing a few games to make the Big 12 title game. I guess technically you could say the best case scenario would be for TCU and Oklahoma State both to win out, and then Oklahoma State to win the revenge matchup in the Big 12 title game. That would probably be best case scenario. But other than that, I think the committee has really shown a willingness to, if you played some people, go ahead and let you in with that one loss, almost regardless of who that loss is to. I mean, if you remember Oklahoma, the year that they made the college football playoff, their losses to a Texas team that didn't even go bowling. And I know some people gave them a little bit of a pass there because, hey, it's a rivalry game or whatever. But is there a difference between, say, Oklahoma State having a 10-2 TCU team on its resume versus 8-4? I don't really know that that's that huge of a difference. Like I said, maybe the best case scenario would be for an 11-1 TCU team to play an 11-1 Oklahoma State team in the Big 12 title game, and Oklahoma State avenge its earlier loss. And at that point, you would feel like Oklahoma State would probably be in, I would think.
We got Kevin Flaherty of 24/7 Sports joining us here for just a little while longer on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. So, KU had the bye week last week, and now they face off against a Texas Tech team that they've had a decent amount of success against, at least put into perspective versus what they've done against other Big 12 opponents. Texas Tech's kind of been one of the, at least somewhat of a surprise, as you mentioned earlier in the conference. So how do you kind of see this game shaking out? Do you like KU's chances whatsoever?
You know, I don't like KU's chances, but that doesn't mean there is no chance, I guess. The interesting thing, I think, about this rivalry is it hasn't exclusively been home and away. You know, Kansas has tested a lot of teams when they've been at Memorial Stadium. Oklahoma State is a great example of a team that, you know, Kansas has played with very closely at Memorial Stadium traditionally and just, you know, gotten sort of waxed whenever they've gone to Stillwater. And this hasn't necessarily been the case in this game. I mean, there have been a couple games where Kansas has had a shot, you know, at Memorial Stadium, but maybe the best chance Kansas has had for a win recently was the road game with Michael Cummings. You know, and so it's interesting in that whenever you think that, okay, Kansas has no chance to win this game, it seems like the Jayhawks put in a pretty good effort, you know. And you could even pay Texas Tech with the way that they played last week, obviously extremely well. You could maybe pay Texas Tech for a letdown, whereas Kansas has had a bye week and, you know, 2 weeks to prepare for what Texas Tech has to bring. But on this, after you look past that, I mean, Texas Tech has done a much better job stopping the run this year than they have in recent years. They've been a lot more fundamentally sound. Getting Dakota Allen back from junior college was a huge part of that. It seems like he's been a big part of their front seven, playing a lot better. And the other part of that is you look at the weak spot of this Kansas defense, and it's so obviously in the secondary. And if there's one team that you really don't want to go into that matchup with a weakness in the secondary, it's Texas Tech, because you can be really strong at three of the four positions or four of your five positions, and they're going to pick on the other guy. And I think that really sets up Texas Tech for a lot of success this weekend.
Instilling optimism into the Kansas faithful. That's why we bring you on, Kevin.
Sounds good. I think we left in the, you know, but there is a snowball chance.
There we go.
So.
Well, appreciate you, man. As always, it's a good time. Well, we'll do it again next week.
All right. Thanks a lot, Nick.
All righty. That's Kevin Flaherty of 24/7 Sports. I'm Nick Schwert. You're listening to Rock Chalk Sports Talk, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.